This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Genesis. Please open your Bibles to the book of Genesis as Pastor Sandy teaches through chapters 30 through 34.
You know, it seems that every time a church grows, the pastor in turn wants to hold some kind of a seminar to teach his own particular methods and his own particular techniques to the pastors. It's as if he's promoting his own cleverness rather than giving the credit and the glory to God. You know, whatever happened, man, that God just blessed us. We weren't doing anything. We didn't know what we were doing. But you know, God blessed us. And God worked, and God accomplished something. Jacob admits, this isn't his brilliance. This is God's blessing that has increased his flock. Verse 10, and it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob, again, this is the dream that may have brought about the arrangement that they had formed earlier. And I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see. All the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. Jacob, in other words, received some insider information. It was like receiving a stock market tip from an angel, no less. Pretty trustworthy source there. They can't send you to jail if it's from an angel. And notice, it's not just any angel. Notice that. We're told, but the angel or messenger of God. Notice who this messenger is. He says, the angel of God. And then he says, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your family. Here, the angel identifies himself as God, as the one true God who met Jacob at Bethel before he left to go to Haran in the first place. Obviously, this angel, if he claims to be God, has to be a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. I believe it was Jesus here that was appearing to Jacob. Verse 14, then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Now, amazingly, the sisters finally come together. They finally agree on something. They agree on their common greed. Are we not considered strangers by him? Where's our inheritance in all this? Where's daddy's allotment to us? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. They no longer have any loyalty to their father Laban. Now they're ready to move on and follow Jacob. Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels. And he carried away all his livestock and all the possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. In other words, Jacob loads up his caravan, and he tries to sneak out of town. Verse 19. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. Now Jacob is sneaking out of town while Laban is out shearing the sheep. He doesn't really want a confrontation with Laban. He just wants to kind of get out of Dodge while he can. He's moving at midnight, you know. And it says here that Rachel had stolen the household idols. Now, there are some that assume by that Rachel was an idolatress. That's not what this means. Remember, the reason that Rebekah sent her son to Haran in the first place was so that he could find a wife that was a believer, not an idolater. I think a better explanation for Rachel's actions here is that these idols, or teraphim as they're called, they symbolized household ownership. They were sort of the family heirlooms, you might say. And so by her taking these, she was essentially saying that the inheritance belonged to her. It was her claim to the family's fortune. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, and that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. I mean, he's trying to avoid any confrontation with Laban. And so he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river Euphrates, and he headed toward the mountains of Gilead, 300 miles away. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. That means that Jacob had a three-day head start. Then Laban took his brethren with him and pursued Jacob for 7 days' journey. And he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad." God was protecting Jacob in advance. And so Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp." Do you really think he would have? I mean, through all of this breeding and through God's blessing, I mean, basically, Jacob has taken over his whole herds, all of his possessions. Now he's leaving with his daughters and his grandkids, and Laban is not a happy camper here. Verse 28, "And you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.' And now you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" He's talking about those household idols. But isn't that a funny thought? Why did you steal my gods? Who'd want a god that could be stolen in the first place? If your god's not powerful enough to not be stolen, you don't have much of a god. This is the folly of idolatry. "Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you.' For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them." He says, "Go, look, find who took your idols and I'll have them killed." Boy, if he had just known who had taken them. Remember, Jacob met the true God at Bethel. And he would never again be tempted to worship a false god. In essence, he's just saying, "Whoever took your idol, just find him, have him killed." He doesn't know it was Rachel. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and into the two maids' tents, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me." Rachel says she can't get up. And she blames it on the time of the month. And what father is going to question that? I mean, Laban just backs off at this point. And he searched but did not find the household god. Smart girl. Then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household idols, your household things have you found? Set it here before my brethren and your brethren, that they may judge between us both." Jacob gets bold here. He stands up to his father-in-law. It's what some of you might need to do. "These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. In the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Man, I've been a faithful shepherd to you. I've watched over your flocks. What more do you want? I've worked long and hard for you. Let me go." And thus I have been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and notice this name, and the fear of Isaac has been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. But notice an unusual name for God. Verse 42 tells us that God is called the fear of Isaac. You remember when Isaac blessed the younger son, Jacob, over the older son, Esau. It was because he'd been tricked in one sense. He had been deceived. But in another sense, God had fulfilled a promise that the younger son would be blessed above the older son. It was really not because of the deception. It was because of the will of God. It was almost as if God had pulled rank on Isaac. And God had done his will in spite of him rather than because of him. And when suddenly he realized, wow, look what I've just done. I've just fulfilled the promise of God, and that's not what I was intending to do. Wow, God was sovereign over this situation. God accomplished his will and his purpose. When it hit Isaac that that's what had happened, yeah, he said, wow. There was a reverence. There was a respect for God. Wow, God is greater than I thought he was. God is bigger. God is over all things. God is working out his will no matter what. And it's the fear of Isaac. Isn't that interesting? And God took that as a name for himself. The fear of Isaac. Verse 43. And Laban answered and said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? Notice he's talking about, you know, these are my children. This is my flock. You know, look what my, these are the children that my daughters have borne. He never mentions that Jacob had a role in all of this. That Jacob was siring these sons, that he was growing this flock. I guess you could say this is a classic case of possessive in-laws. By the way, remember at the creation, God said, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Married couples need to follow that process. They need to leave and then cleave. There needs to be a break with mom and dad. There needs to be a severing of the relationship with the parents, and there needs to be a new bond and a primary bond formed between the husband and the wife. Jacob is wise here in creating some separation between his family and his meddling father-in-law, Laban. Laban suggests, now therefore, come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Then Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there on the heap. Laban called it Jagar Sohadathah, but Jacob called it Galeed. And both terms mean heap of witness. Laban's name was Aramaic, whereas Jacob's name was Hebrew. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore, its name was called Galeed, also Mizpah, because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. Mizpah means watch. And Laban is saying, may God watch you like a hawk. You got my daughters. You got my grandkids. May God keep his eye on you. Verse 50 sounds like a skeptical father-in-law. He says, if you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. Next time a guy comes over to date your teenage daughter, fellas, there's your line for him right there. If you afflict my daughters, if you mistreat my girls, I'm trusting God to work you over, buddy, after I get through with you. Then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar, which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness. that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you shall not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. This pile of rocks, Laban, is going to be the boundary between me and you. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, who was Abraham's father, and the God of their father, judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. And then Laban departed and returned to his place. Understand, Jacob has returned home to Canaan, a humble man. When he left, he was a double-crosser. He returns having been double-crossed by Laban. In fact, in verse 41, he says that Laban had reneged on his promises and changed his wages 10 times. But Jacob has learned that God is faithful. And despite what man might do to you, God is faithful. And that God keeps his promises, and that God has prospered his herds, and that God has delivered him from the hands of Laban, and God has blessed him not because of his ingenuity and his manipulation, but because of God's grace. Now this man, Jacob, is a man who once trusted in his own schemes, but now he's learning that he can trust in God. Here is a man who is growing in his faith. When we come to verse 1 of chapter 32, and we have a description of an event that must have been a profound experience in Jacob's life. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means double camp. Jacob realizes that God is now camping with him. What an amazing experience this must have been. It's amazing. It just kind of gets passed over in one verse. But he saw the angels of God. And he saw them camping with him. He saw them watching over him. He saw that he was not alone, but that God had sent forces to protect him and go before him. Yes, there's a physical camp that's occupied by Jacob's family, but there's also a spiritual camp that's occupied by angels on assignment, angels that have been sent to protect him. And if you're a child of God, I believe that there's a troop that's been dispatched, an army of angels that are camping with you too. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14 refers to angels as ministering spirits to the heirs of salvation. That's what angels are. They're there to minister to you, to protect you, to watch over you. Hey, do I believe in guardian angels? You betcha I do. And I keep mine working overtime, I'll tell you. Verse 3. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Speak thus to my lord Esau, thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." Now Jacob has just left an adversary in Laban, but now he faces a confrontation with another adversary, Esau. And remember the last time he heard from Esau? Remember, his brother wanted to kill him. Then the messengers returned to Jacob saying, We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. And notice there's no indication here of Esau's motive, just that he's coming to meet him with 400 men. And I don't know about you, but an army of 400 men marching across the desert doesn't sound like the welcome wagon to me. I'm sure that Jacob was shaking in his boots. As a matter of fact, it says, "So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two companies. And he said, 'If Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company which is left will escape.'" You know, he's designing an evasive maneuver here in the case of an attack. You know, Jacob really doesn't know what to expect from Esau. All he knows is that Esau's anger and his hatred has had 20 years to now brew and come to fruition. And he's worried, is he on the warpath or not? Well, verse 9. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant, for I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. And then he reminds God of his promises. I like this. You know, this is always a good way to pray. I hope that when you pray, you remind God of his promises. He says, for you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. This is the first recorded prayer in all of the Bible, right here. And it's a man who prays the promises of God. I'm telling you, that's a good thing to pray. So he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau his brother, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams. Not a bad thing. 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. This was a sizable peace offering. And he's going to send it ahead of him. Then he delivered them to the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass over before me and put some distance between successive droves. In other words, spread it out. It'll appear more impressive that way. And he commanded the first one, saying, when Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going? Whose are these in front of you? Then you shall say, they are your servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he also is behind us. And so he commanded the second, the third, and all who followed the drove, saying, in this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and also say, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. And he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. And so the present went on before him, but he himself lodged that night in the camp. Jacob is still calculating. He's still a plotter. He's still a planner. Here he's calculating for maximum effect. He sends his gifts out in waves of welcome to sort of gradually soften up Esau's heart. Here's the only problem. Once again, Jacob concocts a plan and relies on his own wisdom. He's trying to manipulate the situation rather than trust in God. And of course, this has been his lifelong problem. God is about to cure him of it, though, once and for all. Verse 22. And he arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. The name Jabbok means emptying, and it's a tiny little stream that comes off of the mountains and empties down into the Jordan River. But this name is also prophetic. For here at the Jabbok, this is where Jacob empties himself of his confidence and his self-reliance and his self-dependence and self-assurance. He took his family, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was alone. And underline those words, Jacob was alone at the Jabbok. Jacob comes to the end of his rope. He has emptied himself of all of his confidence. He is alone. He is vulnerable. Now Jacob is worried that at any time Esau is going to jump out of the bushes and try to kill him. Mama isn't around anymore to save his skin. Jacob knows that this time the only thing that he can do is to be totally dependent upon God.
That concludes the teaching portion of today's broadcast with Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Join us next time as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the first book of the Bible, Genesis. You can learn a great deal about Pastor Sandy by visiting our website. The web address is sandyadams.org. That's sandyadams.org. Simply click on the radio program option from the main menu. When you click on the radio program option at the website, you'll find today's message and many other messages from Pastor Sandy. You can download today's teaching, listen again, subscribe to the podcast, or browse the archive of messages. If you live in the Stone Mountain, Georgia area, or will be visiting anytime soon, you can get directions and times for our worship services. Again, the website for all this information is sandyadams.org. We love hearing how God's Word touches the lives of His followers. So please log on to sandyadams.org and click on the Contact Us link and send us a note about how today's message has encouraged you. Your feedback helps us tremendously. Once again, you've been listening to the Daily Bible Teaching Program of Pastor Sandy Adams. Please tune in next time as we continue through the book of Genesis. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.